The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, questions we've never asked before. Could this be the turning point for Spurs? Can anyone beat City? Can Mark Hughes keep his job? Questions we actually haven't asked before. Are Huddersfield actually quite good? Has Jefferson Lerma ever hit a volley like that before? And is Alan Hutton the new Lionel Messi? Also, how far have you travelled to watch a game be delayed, delayed again, postponed, rescheduled, delayed and called off? We'll ask Jonathan Wilson in Argentina. All that plus a European roundup, your questions all neatly packaged into 1 hour, or perhaps a little bit more, of low-grade football conversation on today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have an all-star cast today, nominated for the Football Supporters Federation Football Writer of the Year. Susie Rack is here. Susie, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for coming.
It's good to be here.
Pod debut.
Yeah, a little bit nervous.
Don't be nervous. Respected journalist Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Are you nervous?
No.
When was the last time you were nervous?
Pre-broadcast.
Not anything.
I remember being quite nervous just before the start of my first ever TalkSport radio show with you.
Okay. Nominated for the Football Supporters Federation Football Writer of the Year, and also on the list of respected journalists, Barney Ronay.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Which of those two is more important to you, being respected or being nominated, Barney?
Well, I mean, I find journalism awards pretty nauseating, to be honest. Almost all of them. I've been to some terrible occasions of... I don't really understand why journalists give themselves so many awards. It doesn't make any sense. But I think that the Football Supporters Federation actually do something useful, so I can utterly see the point of their awards, because it publicises what they do. And they're more important than ever now, because football clubs and sport itself is so distanced from its traditional base. So I fully support the Football Supporters Federation Awards.
Excellent news. Are you coming to the do? Are we all sitting on the same table?
Yeah, I'm coming. Yeah, you'll be there?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm good.
Unless we don't win and then I just go home.
Yeah. There's always a chance of not winning.
Yeah, there's quite a high chance, I imagine. Spurs 3, Chelsea 1. Barney, you were there, weren't you?
Yeah, it was a really good game. I really enjoyed it. First 15 minutes were brilliant. Spurs were brilliant. It was really hard to understand what was happening to Chelsea. The yellow shapes were moving in really weird patterns, and they were just completely overrun. And I think people often overstate the importance of tactics and managers. In particular, a lot of people who come on this pod with glasses who write books about stuff. But that was a real case of Pochettino getting his tactics exactly right and doing the other team really well. They kind of sat on Jorginho and stopped him passing the ball around, and it was really impressive.
You wrote in your piece, with 16 minutes gone, it was clear the witching hour was at hand. Are you referring to any sort of witches-based curse?
No, I regretted that immediately. I've tried to move on from then. It's not a moment that I'm proud of. Still, you look at Barry now and there's a feeling of hurt and tenderness. And no, it was just something to say, really.
Susie, what did you make of David Luiz's performance?
I thought it was appalling. Him and Rudiger pulled all over the place. I thought the positioning for Kane's goal was absolutely terrible. For Son's, terrible. And Jorginho was absolutely caught out by... As Barney said, the tactics of Pochettino in sticking Ali on him constantly. Chelsea are reliant on going forward. And this time their defence were completely sidelined.
You enjoyed watching Luis, didn't you, Baz?
Yeah, I'm very much an admirer of his. I think he's a terrific player who occasionally gets a bad press he doesn't deserve. But when he has a nightmare, no one does nightmarish performances quite like him. You know, it was just quite staggeringly awful, and he was basically at fault for all three goals. His sort of non-tackle on Son, when Son scored that wonderful goal, individual goal, was just a thing of remarkable beauty. I loved it. But that game kind of reminded me a little of the Wales hammering the Republic of Ireland couple of months ago, insofar as Spurs were very, very good, but Chelsea were so bad that they made p- possibly them look better than they were, you know, and which is not particularly to take away from Tottenham's performance, but there were two extremes there. Tottenham playing as well as they have this season and Chelsea just not being at the races at all. And Maurizio Sarri looked a bit shocked afterwards. I think he couldn't quite believe what he'd seen.
I liked Sarri's lines at the end, Barney, when he just said, "I didn't like anybody." You know, there was any positives? No.
He's really good, Sarri, isn't he? He's really honest and sort of like a normal guy. I agree with Barry about David Luiz, though. I don't think it means that he should be dropped or that he's a terrible footballer or anything. He's a really good footballer. He's a real leader. And what he does is really good. He's really good on the ball and he's powerful. He just has these moments where he disappears off the planet. And you notice then, in those moments, how good professional footballs are most of the time. Because when they suddenly become mortal, it looks ridiculous. I mean, how many games have you played where someone's slightly ducked out of the way of a ball or missed a tackle like that? I mean, a lot probably. Well, I certainly have. But to see a pro do it, you suddenly realise how high the level is, and you know, he just has those moments.
I can kind of forgive the first one when he bends out of the way, because I reckon he thought Kane has shot from so far out that keeper should get it. The second one, though, I cannot for the life of me understand why he's running so far. I mean, it's just bizarre. If he just stood still, Susie, he would have made Son have to do something different.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that first one where he turns his back on Kane, they all stood off Kane. I don't think anyone thought he was going to take a shot from that far out. But yeah, like you say, for the Son goal, I thought it was just crazy to move. He should have stood still.
What's happened to Moussa Sissoko, Barney? Because he's a joy now, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's obviously another guy who's very talented, but there's something really fun about his renaissance, and he was brilliant in the opening minutes. Again, he had Kovacic, you know, on whatever kind of, maybe a pan rustica like you, whatever kind of toast he has. And there's something really fun about the way his limbs kind of flail around. I mean, he's a really powerful, you know, good athlete, but he's slightly ungainly. And to see him having a renaissance is really quite fun, because he was really deeply unpopular. I mean, his name was kind of mud for quite a while. I remember standing at a mix zone at the Euros, and he came through, and there were a few Northeast journalists there, and they just kind of rolled their eyes as he walked past. And like, it was like, that guy has spent, you know, he spent the last 6 months doing absolutely nothing. And he looked at them with the same kind of disdain. It was not a good end there. But no, I mean, you know, good luck to him. He gave it everything.
Does this mean, Susie, that Sarri will move N'Golo Kante back to holding midfield? They made the point on the TV, didn't they? And I think they're probably right, that if Kante had been where Jorginho was, Son wouldn't have just run past him.
Well, you'd think that. You never know. I mean, like you say, Luiz can be brilliant 1 minute and terrible the next. But yeah, I'd like to see Kante move back into the middle and play in the deeper role that we know he's so brilliant at.
But then where do you put Jorginho? I mean, that's the question, right?
Yeah.
Well, it seems like they're asking Kante to do something different, to play slightly further forward, because he loves the way Jorginho passes. But I would ask Kante to do that passing role instead. You know, ask him to do that, to develop that part of his game. Because he's a good, I mean, he may not be a Jorginho obsessive, but he's a good passer, and he seems a bit wasted at the moment.
And I guess other teams will see what Spurs did and just put someone quick and fit on Jorginho.
Yeah, it does happen in the Premier League, doesn't it? People do something and then it gets repeated. But, you know, it's kind of details, isn't it? If David Luiz makes that tackle, we're probably not saying, you know, who knows? Jorginho is a good player. I'm sure they can come up with a response.
Barry, Johnny Blaine, the stats guy for the Premier League, says Kane, Ali and Son and Eriksen start together for the first time in the league this season. They did it 20 times last year.
Yeah, well, Son has been away, obviously missed the start of the season, was away for over a month, and Eriksen's had his stomach issues, which I'm not sure they're totally resolved either. So, yeah, it's quite understandable, but they combine with devastating effect because they're all very good players.
Spurs have Inter on Wednesday. Need a win, otherwise they're out of the Champions League. Chelsea, obviously, playing the Europa League on Thursday. First win for Claudio Ranieri. Fulham 3, Southampton 2. Baz, this was a great game, wasn't it?
Southampton took the lead, and interestingly, after the game, Cedric, the defender, came out and said, even when we were 1-0 up, I didn't think we were going to win, which is straight, you know, it's quite possibly, well, he obviously did think that, and it's probably no surprise he thought that, but given their record, but it's surprising he came out and said it. But they probably did enough to get something from the game, but once again, they didn't. And Mark Hughes didn't really, you know, he's a good man to come up with an excuse, but he didn't really have any after that, and it was a very good win for Fulham.
Susie, do you feel sorry for Mark Hughes?
I mean, 63% possession, and you concede 3 goals like that. It's hard to feel sorry for him. I mean, his record's terrible at the moment. I just think that Southampton have something there. They can control games. They have got Armstrong who can score. They've got other players who can score, but they're just not. They're not getting the right starting 11 out. They're not playing. They don't look like they have any system.
It's a sort of a shame about Mark Hughes, isn't it? I mean, he's so brave. You know, he struggles on in the face of all these people who don't want his team to win, the refereeing decisions and all that. And I still look at him, and I remember, you must remember Mark Hughes.
Such a great player.
As a player. I mean, he was so heroic. He was like this sort of Grecian profile, and he was so strong and uncomplaining, and he just kind of moved about the pitch in his own little space. And now I look back and think, well, maybe all that time he was internally, he was whinging about people not giving the ball and the referee not helping him and everything, the world was against him. And somehow even his heroism seems tarnished.
Would it have been better for his legacy to have never become a manager?
Well, I mean, as a player, he was absolutely fantastic. He has always been a bit like this, hasn't he? But I think he's got maybe slightly worse as time has gone on.
Mm. I mean, his record at Southampton, he's won 3 games out of 21. That's pretty dismal, you know. And he got credit last season, you know, people say, oh, he kept them, came in and he kept them up, and you know, I wouldn't say it was the most heroic escape act of all time. You know, I don't think they were in that much danger of going down, to be honest. He almost got 2 teams relegated last season. That's the way I would look at it, rather than keeping one up.
Ranieri's 2 wins away from having the same number of wins as Fulham manager as Mark Hughes is as Southampton manager. Did anybody see Ranieri do anything different with Fulham?
He's an organiser, isn't he, despite all the dilly-ding stuff. I mean, he's a classic Italian manager, organises a team very well. And we often get instant games when someone comes in like that, because there's a few simple things you can do differently. But we'll see. I mean, we'll see where he goes.
West Ham 0, Manchester City 4. Jonathan says, why is the general narrative that City are walking away with the league? They're only 2 points clear. Susie Rack.
I think the fact that after this game, Guardiola said they were lucky, that they kind of were a little bit weary after the international break, and had players coming back but still won 4-0, shows that their level is so high. I think it's hard to write off Liverpool. They are still well in it. They do look sturdier than last season. They haven't quite hit their strides go forward. But they are grinding out performances. I mean, you could have said that last season Liverpool would have dropped points this weekend, and they didn't. So despite kind of appearances, they are managing to keep pace.
I think the narrative that they're walking away with the league is to do with the fact that they're so far ahead of their closest rivals in every sort of statistical department. Plus, you could just tell by looking at them that they're going to walk away with the league, and teams around them will continue to take points off each other, and I still fully expect City to win by minimum 12 points.
Yeah, they've had some difficult away games, and Kevin De Bruyne hasn't really come back to fitness, who is their best player, so it's looking rosy.
It is. Aymeric Laporte looks like such a good player. I cannot understand how he's not in the France side. When they're picking, are they picking Mamadou Sakho above him? That seems a very strange decision to me.
Yeah, well, I think he's really come on this season. Mm. I'm not sure last season it was quite the same. He looks brilliant, doesn't he? And the partnership with, well, he was Otamendi this weekend, but with Stones is really good, left and right. They're both really similar looking guys. I think they're born like a day apart. and one's left-footed, one's right-footed, and there's a weird kind of twin-like thing going on there, but it works.
We've had this email for you, Barney. In the light of the pardon for Mr. Hedges and the lack of critical judgment on the fans of any other clubs associated with the UAE, or for that matter, those associated with Russia, China, or numerous betting companies, will Mr. Ronay apologise to all Man City fans for his ridiculous finger wagging at them?
It's kind of amazing sometimes to realise how confused some people are, which has been, you know, is a constant revelation working in this business, but particularly with this issue. I mean, let's be clear, this is a really good result. Something really good has happened here, and the UAE has decided to pardon someone who was convicted under summary justice of an incredibly serious offence, having been imprisoned and, his wife says, treated in conditions akin to torture for 6 months, having signed a confession which was in Arabic that he didn't understand. Now, something really good's happened here. And part of that has been pressure, mainly from political pressure from the Foreign Office, but also it's been mentioned in the media. And the message here is, if you have a PR campaign running in this company, in this country, and you do something which doesn't look very good, people will speak up. So to interpret this as a message not to speak up about things is absolutely bizarre. This is a victory for pointing out an injustice and for pointing out that we won't be completely played in that way. Possibly be worth asking Mr. Hedges and his family if they'd rather people hadn't written about this. And certainly it's an encouragement to keep speaking about it. But I mean, the emailer is right. Like, this happens at other clubs. It's something new that we all have to adjust to. And I think it's probably something that we'll be looking at more in future. It's not totally confined to Manchester City, but this was a very specific case in quite a sort of strange process. And I think everybody who spoke out about it will feel really delighted. The idea that anybody needs to apologise over this probably should be directed towards, A, the people who imprisoned this man after a five-minute trial. So anyway, that's my reply.
Does it taint the football for you?
No, but that's the thing about it. City are brilliant, aren't they? And I love the way they've done it. I don't think they've bought success in the way some people say. I think Guardiola's done it perfectly. They haven't bought bolt-on celebrity stars. They've bought players who he's improved. I mean, that's the beauty of what's happened there. It's been done so well. I love that team, love watching them. They are great. But this is a totally different thing. We're talking about a club being used for PR purposes. The two are totally separate.
Mm. Apparently, West Ham fans were applauding the beautiful football, you know, that was taking place in front of them.
Even for all that, and it was a brilliant performance by City, West Ham still had at least four good scoring opportunities, none of which they failed to all of which they failed to convert. And Pep Guardiola was quite, you know, conscious of that afterwards. And one imagines on the training ground this morning or tomorrow, or whatever, he will, you know, be administering a few little bollockings here and there. And he's quite clearly not going to let standards slip on his watch.
They go to Lyon on Tuesday in the Champions League. They lost at home to Lyon in the reverse fixture. Susie, you touched on Liverpool's win at Watford as a game that potentially they would have dropped points at last season. I think you might have a point. The free kick from Trent Alexander-Arnold was superb, wasn't it? And the fact that he has the confidence and the support of his teammates to take it, given the amount of talent in Liverpool's team, is a statement in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's standing alongside Salah and saying he wants to take that free kick, that's a big statement from such a young player. And it was beautiful. I think, yeah, last season they dropped three points at Vicarage Road. This season, obviously, they were down to 10 men and managed to kind of get through this game. And I think that's the difference in their side this season. They've got a lot more kind of fight to them. I think their spine's a lot stronger. Shaqiri was fantastic in that game. I thought he's the architect of everything that was good about them. And I think, you know, when their front three click in the way that they kind of showed signs of doing, they will challenge City. I think they will challenge City for a big stretch of the season. I don't think they'll win the league, but I think they will be up there for a big stretch.
And for that third goal, the pace of Robertson, there's a sort of Gareth Bale-like quality to Robertson, I think. In just that extreme pace, you think, he can't get that and jump the tackle, not just be fouled. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it's kind of like, do you remember that goal Bale scored for Real Madrid where he kind of ran off the pitch and back onto yeah. it again? And I can see why you're making the comparison. Yeah, he's an absolutely terrific player, and you know, people were a bit baffled when he went to Liverpool and then didn't play for ages, and everyone thought it was very odd, but what a purchase he's been.
Hmm. I'm a big fan of the red card, because Henderson was told about 5 minutes before the second yellow to just calm down by the ref, and then committed the foul and walked straight down.
I like the way he barged. Who was it he barged into? He barged into Capu and didn't even have to change direction, just kept going towards the tunnel without breaking stride. It was, you can't complain about that. I mean, Jurgen Klopp said afterwards he seemed to find it quite funny, and he said that he had been about to substitute Henderson because he could see it coming, but he didn't get the board up in time. So
he's suspended for the Merseyside derby. Liverpool go to PSG on Wednesday. Huge game.
Oh, I'm going to that.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to it?
It's going to be amazing. I'm really looking forward to it, yeah. I mean, it's such a big game for both of them. And PSG on those European nights, it's actually it's a really good atmosphere. The ground is really loud. In a slightly strange way, it's like some people having fun near a game of football. You know how French people like singing? They kind of sing in that festive way. But the atmosphere is brilliant. And I think it'd be brilliant. It's really hard to call either way.
Yeah, the whole group is hard to call, isn't it? We'll react to that on the pod on Thursday. And that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start with Huddersfield's excellent win at Wolves. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. This is from Richard, who says, I've bought tickets for 3 non-pod listening mates for the live show this week. If they do listen to today's pod, as I've asked them to do, can you give them a flavour of what to expect? It's okay, I've told them about Barry. Barry, what should they expect from the live show on Thursday?
Long guitar solos, pyrotechnics, and a scintillating 90 minutes or so of football chat.
Mm. Can I just ask what "it's okay, I've told them about Barry" means?
Yeah, I don't know what it means either. I just read it out.
I had a problem this morning. I told my 11-year-old that I was coming in to do this podcast, and he said, with Barry, he's funny. And obviously I had to say, you mean Max. Max is quite funny. He's funny. Barry's funny. And I said, well, you mean there's some good interaction? The podcast is generally funny. Yeah, that's probably what you mean. He said, no, Barry's funny.
He is only 11.
Yeah, so. And he's also very backwards.
Mm. Okay, good. Me, Wilson, Barry and TBC will be with you on Thursday night. Wolves 0, Huddersfield 2. Susie, I had got my narrative ready that Huddersfield weren't going to win again and that they were hopeless and they were incapable of scoring goals, of playing any sort of good, positive attacking football. And I also had my narrative that Wolves are the best team ever to be promoted, and now I have to tear them both up and throw them away.
Yeah, despite what the manager says, that I think that was by far their best game of the season. Billing was just superb for me. The llama, I think, as you called him a couple of weeks ago. That clearance off the line, then his movement, his passing, him, Hogg and Smoy together just really, really clicked. Great awareness. I thought Wolves just sat way too deep. They set up too defensively for that game. You're playing the team that's bottom of the table, and they didn't look like they were going out to win that.
I think even at that level, complacency sets in. I don't know about you, Barry. I think you go, well, they're bottom, they can't score. This will be a nice day out for us.
I wouldn't necessarily agree. I think that's the performance from Huddersfield that David Wagner has been saying was in the post. You know, he's made the point that they've been quite unlucky. They've been playing well, but haven't been able to score. And the lads on Gillette Soccer Saturday on at the weekend, they put together this compilation of, I was just watching it, the amount of times various Huddersfield players have hit the woodwork this season, And I was watching it, and there was just one incident after. I wasn't just like skimming the paint. It was like thumping off the crossbar, thumping the foot of the post. I was thinking, is this ever going to end? It was about 15 different incidents. So I think they have been a bit unlucky. They haven't been playing as poorly as their position in the table would suggest. And Wagner completely out-tacticked his opposite number at the weekend. And I think, like you were saying earlier, that other teams will copy what Spurs did to Jorginho. I think this will, or other teams will now copy what Huddersfield did in nullifying Moutinho and Ruben Neves. So,
and how did they do that? Just standing on them?
Well, they outnumbered them and smothered them, I think. You know, they were just too energetic for them and basically put them both out of the game. I think Neves got taken off at halftime.
At Raising the Crossbar says, is Aaron Moy the best centre midfielder outside the top six? Susie?
Well, he certainly looked it yesterday, but I'm not sure.
What do you reckon, Barney? I'm trying to think. I mean,
you're a huge fan of his, aren't you?
Well, last season I thought he was absolutely superb. I haven't really seen it this year. But he's just takes the ball in very tight areas. He keeps the ball. His movement is excellent. His decision-making is really good. Sorry, producer Jonathan's just written, Barry's come back as Barry White.
Yeah.
You had a break for a glass of water.
Is everything okay?
Huh?
Is everything okay?
I'm fine, yeah. I could feel myself croaking towards the end of that last soliloquy of mine. Anyway.
Well, Huddersfield is a very emotional subject.
Where do you stand on Aaron Moy, Barney?
He's really good. He's fun to watch. There are a lot of good central midfielders around, not in the top six. I mean, there's players who sometimes just have a day where you think, wow, I mean, Tom Kearney, you know, if you watch him on a good day, he's absolutely fantastic. Tom Huddleston, watch him have a good game and you think, my God, this guy is talented. You know, everyone. Do you think Moy, sometimes I think really bald players or really blonde players can benefit because they stand out?
Well, I mean, the same with Fellaini. I will get to United, but I just didn't.
Well, I see also David Luiz, you know, just a distinctive barnet or lack of one can make you look better or a lot worse than you are.
But I was wondering with Fellaini if actually he'd have had any sort of career if he'd not had that enormous hair. Is that going too far?
Well, I mean,
how different would it have been? What different paths would he have gone down?
We can only speculate, Max.
Yeah, I mean, he does have some very obvious qualities.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, it's the he would still be the best chest controller in world football, which is, you know, not a laurel you wear lightly. Did he always have quite such extreme hair? I'm not sure he did. I think when he first came through, he was fairly restrained. I think it bloomed.
But I think it's as a marketing strategy, it's excellent. I mean, the same way as, you know, Adebayak in Fenwa, he's so massive that's. You know,
he lives really near me. I see him in the Sainsbury's now and then. He is a really nice man.
Oh, he's lovely.
In fact, I don't know if I can say this, but my wife teaches his son, who is just the nicest boy. And all the teachers love Akin Fenwa. Whenever he comes in, they're like, oh, he's so nice.
What's in his supermarket trolley? I imagine it's just like pounds of chicken,
six dozen eggs.
Yeah, he's quite evangelical about his protein intake, isn't he?
As we were saying, Bournemouth 1, Arsenal 2. That Jefferson Lerma own goal, I'm not saying it's in the absolute sort of highest echelons of own goals, but it's certainly, you know, certainly in the Premier League of own goals or top of the Championship.
Yeah, well, his own goal prompted Sky last night to just put on a compilation, which, you know, would have made horror viewing for Richard Dunn, I think, featured about 10 times. Jamie Carragher and Frank Sinclair, they were the three who featured at the end. But there were some spectacular ones. I mean, the one Lee Dixon scored over David Seaman's head in a match against Coventry, this chip from about 45 yards.
Jamie Pollock is absolutely glorious, isn't it? The Manchester City one when he chips it over the defender. He chips it over the attacker, doesn't he? And then heads it over the keeper. It's stunning.
I liked the Popovic back heel for me. That was
Remind me of that one.
A little back heel for Palace against Portsmouth. It was in that Sky compilation. Really beautiful. Beautiful little back heel that chips the keeper.
In lower league ones, Wayne Hatswell in an FA Cup match. It's one where the ball's bouncing on the in the six-yard box and he steadies himself and then he puts it, absolutely smashes it in the top corner. And there's one, if you look out for it, from Chris Brass, who absolutely hammers the ball against
like
his own head.
It's an incredible piece of skill, isn't it? If you did that on Copacabana. But I think fewer own goals these days, partly back pass role, partly keepers and defenders who are sort of better at passing rather than these terrible...
You say fewer own goals. Are there... By the same token, there seems to be a lot more deflected goals than there was back in my day.
Well, I think that's just that we stare at every single piece of action so closely. I'm sure it used to happen all the time. Mm. I can remember goals in FA Cup finals and people weren't quite sure whether it was an own goal or not. But now we see everything.
Susie, you're an Arsenal fan. Good victory for you, considering no Lacazette. Ozil not used at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's another game where we've got it at half-time, not ahead, but when you win, it kind of matters less. I thought the comments on Ertzel after the game were very interesting, that he wasn't necessarily tough enough for that fixture. That worries me a little bit. I'm a big Ertzel fan.
If you're not tough enough for Bournemouth... I mean,
where are you tough enough for? Yeah, no.
Was it not a case that Emery wanted to play this 3-4-3 system and there wasn't a place for Ozil in it? And if that is the case, what does that mean for him for the future? Because that seems to be Emery's preferred formation.
Yeah, it's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, like I say, I'm a massive Ertzel fan. I think he does a lot for us, and I think we lacked a little bit of creativity in that game. Partly from the loss of Lacazette as well. I think when those three are working together, it works very well. I think we should find a place for Ertzel. In my opinion, we should be building the team from him in the middle. But it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out and whether how he responds to being dropped again.
It's a brilliant thing, though, isn't it? I mean, I've enjoyed, ever since Ozil has been in England, the fury that he generates over a player who's obviously brilliant at passing and actually runs a hell of a lot more than people notice. But the fury over his, you know, refusal to go thundering into tackles and all that kind of stuff. And the times when he does, to be honest, slightly seem to... I mean, Arsene Wenger, am I right in thinking Arsene Wenger did stop playing him in away games for a while as well?
Yeah, there was a whole little period and he didn't play... some of the away fixtures in Europe and things as well. I mean, you can understand why it's done. You can see the criticisms, but at the same time, I think he fits into the team if you make it work.
Oh, it's sad that you're picking players who aren't as beautiful to watch as him. You know, that's
well, it was kind of weird Arsenal performance because while they were the better team. Not by a huge amount, but what they were the better team. They had the worst player in the pitch in Mkhitaryan. And Xhaka, I thought, wasn't much better than him, but he still contributed two assists. So, you know, is that a good performance or a bad performance? I don't really know.
I still think Xhaka is another misunderstood player in that he's a really good passer. But because he's a bit of a sort of, got this kind of slight hard man chops, people think he's a defensive midfielder. But I'm not sure he is. I think he's just a passer. And when you put him back there, he runs around and tries to tackle a lot. But you don't really see the best of him.
Unai Emery says the gangster drama Peaky Blinders is helping him perfect his English. He watches it to relax, he says.
That explains it.
I mean, I really hope he goes full Brummy, you know.
He's famous for massively meticulous video analysis, isn't he? Rewinds. And I mean, I wonder if he does that with Peaky Blinders, if he watches it in that way, constantly rewinding every frame and dissecting the plot. I bet he's a laugh to watch a box set with.
It's like years and years. Everton 1, Cardiff 0. I was really expecting Neil Warnock to be furious after this, Barry, and he wasn't.
No, we keep waiting for Mount Warnock to erupt, and it hasn't happened yet. He was quite philosophical about a few decisions that didn't go his team's way. I thought Cardiff played reasonably well, and I wouldn't be too... upset with them. I think they're kind of evolving as a team, and I can see them staying up, but they do need a bit, they need a striker. They're playing full back Patterson up front at the moment, and Warnock has said they need to get a couple of players in January to have any hope of staying up. I wouldn't say they're absolutely doomed in the manner that I probably thought they would be before the season started, because I can see improvement, but it'll be touch and go.
And Everton are now in the race for sixth place with Manchester United, which could go to the wire, Barney.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I doubt it. Well, I objected to the BBC edit of this game on Match of the Day, where they showed a mildly contentious throw-in and an example of someone falling over, and then tried to make this into a story. All these terrible refereeing decisions that affect... I thought that was really contrived, and an example of television trying to create some sort of narrative about poor refereeing. And as Barry says, Warnock didn't really bite on it. I mean, he seemed okay with it. But watching, I thought, why are they showing us this throw-in? It's completely irrelevant. And it reminded me of Brian Clough objecting to Jimmy Hill, saying you invent controversy. I mean, Cluffy would have been sort of furious. It seemed pointless. You know, talk about the tactics. Tell us about the game a bit, not a throw-in that could have gone a different way.
Well, when VAR comes in, which I know you'll be very happy about.
Well, yeah, more discussion of referees.
Mm, that's the dream.
Well, hopefully less discussion of referees. I mean, I'm sure it can work well.
Man United, as I said, in the race for sixth place with Everton, a goalless draw at home to Palace. Susie, Michael says, can Manchester United just sack Jose already so there'll be some excitement at Old Trafford?
I think it's obvious that he's lost the dressing room. I think his comments in the week about the spoiled kids are obviously like an accurate description of the game, but naming players I think was a mistake in the context of the club at the moment. I get that the aim was describing how to push those players onto the next level to make them elite players, but in the context of a club in the kind of state it is at the moment, picking on young players who are generally some of the brightest sparks of their game is a mistake. I agree with all his comments afterwards. They did lack heart. They looked lethargic.
Well, Palace should have won, shouldn't they?
Palace should have won. I kind of always thought United looked almost 5 seconds behind Palace. They were just lucky that Palace weren't clinical enough.
I think his latest comments, which have been perceived in some quarters as being another attempt to dig out his young players, I'm prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt on this occasion. I think it was more a sort of general Abraham Simpson-esque old man waves fist at cloud thing, you know, where he's going. Just the younger generation in general are soft. Whether he's right or not is open to debate, but I didn't see these comments he did in this interview in Spain as a direct dig at his own players. He's just using them as an example of how the youth of today have everything too easy. I don't necessarily agree, and you know, if that's the case in high level sport, but I'm prepared to give him a pass on this one. But he digs them out so often that they might not see it that way, and they may have taken it personally.
Yeah, and when he says that, he's talking to every single person he's ever going to have to work with in his current profession. So there's literally nowhere to go. If you're saying, I can't communicate with these people, well, you know, bye. I mean, you have to realise with Mourinho, I think he will, it's obvious he'll be gone at the end of the season. I think he thinks that. And everything he says and does is geared towards his own legacy, his own achievements, to creating a story that reflects well on him. That's how he succeeds, and it's how he fails. Whatever he says is something to do with the Jose Mourinho persona.
So if you're a Manchester United fan, you just have to sit and wait. I mean, there's rumours of De Gea going to PSG. The squad, you feel, well, I don't know, how much rebuilding does it need, or does it just need a better, younger, more enthusiastic manager?
It just needs a coherent process applied to it. Sometimes any old idea is a good idea, and at the moment you just see the leftovers, the chop and change of too many managers coming and going, and signings that don't make too much sense, that are possibly bought for the wrong reasons. There's still a half a Alex Ferguson defence left with a few star players bolted on. They just need a they need more than one guy making the decisions. They need a the one thing that Manchester City have done brilliantly is having a totally coherent plan all the way through. This team is the result of years of planning and working towards it, and that's the way to make a sports team work.
How much of an effect will a new manager be able to have? You know, the team is run by bankers. That's what a lot of the fans see as the biggest problem. They're not looking for a club that's going to necessarily compete at the top level unless it's financially.
Well, you're right. It's really weird, isn't it? Because how much longer can this go? How much longer can Man United go on raking in all this revenue while being a very boring team to watch? He finishes fifth or sixth. It can't go on forever. At some point, young people will think, well, I'm not interested in them, I'm interested in something else. So they've allowed this thing to drift on because the people who count the figures are happy. But it's really strange, isn't it? Why would you want to be Man United's noodle partner? I mean, why?
And now you've got United fans wanting Middle Eastern states to come in and take over their club.
Ah, football fans just want to win, don't they? They want the good times to roll.
Brighton 1, Leicester 1. The big talking point, James Maddison's red card. He took to Instagram. I'm sure you follow him. He's at Madders, Barry.
I'm not on Instagram.
Oh,
but I saw what he posted, yes. He was very contrite.
Barry, I think people would like to see you. What's the verb? To gram?
To gram? What? Rack up lines of Charlie?
People might like that, but they'd like to see you take photos of whatever happens in your life. Here it is. Here's James Maddison saying, apologies to everyone for what happened today. Nobody wants to see diving in our beautiful game, he said. I was anticipating contact that never came. But that's no excuse. It's a mistake and I will learn from it. Lads showed fantastic fight and determination to get us back in the game. Go home with a more than deserved point. So he's apologised.
Was that preceded by say something like ...
That's nice to hear. I mean, I think we've all anticipated contact that never came in our lives. And,
I've stopped a long time ago.
In the Football League, Tom says, is Alan Hutton the new Lionel Messi? What a lovely goal from Alan Hutton, Barry.
Yeah, I didn't watch the game. I saw bits of it with you in the studio, but I was unaware of the goal, and then I saw someone had posted the footage on Twitter, and I couldn't believe my eyes. Brilliant.
I think there is a Twitter handle called Has Hutton Scored Yet? And I don't know if that's been going for like 100 years.
I did. One mate of mine just tweeted that Birmingham City should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves, which kind of sums it up.
It's brilliant, though, isn't it? I mean, moments like that in a derby game are just, it will never be forgotten.
Because when he picked it up, you just wondered if Alan Hutton was thinking, you know, when he gets that ball there, does anybody think, I know how this is going to end up? Not even Alan Hutton would think, this is how it's going to end up. And at one point, I played with this Geordie guy who never, ever scored. And he was put through once, and he just, as he shaped up to shoot, he went, how are we? I'm going to score a goal. Oh, motherfucker. Someone came in and tackled him. And I imagine that would be how Alan Hutton's brain would have worked, except he put it in. Anyway, Villa beat Birmingham 4-2. And Birmingham were one up and hit the post about a second before Villa equalised. And Villa equalised about a second before they went 2-1 up. In other surprising news, Angel Rangel scored twice in a 2-2 draw at Stoke. Has anyone seen the footage of Steve McLaren? After Rangel's first goal, he scored a header, and it cuts.
So scored for who?
QPR. That's where he is.
I thought Angel Rangel retired about 2 years ago.
Anyway, he's just signed for QPR. He's been there this season. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, perhaps Steve McLaren was as surprised as you, Barry, that he was there, because it cuts to McLaren while QPR are celebrating, and he looks really angry, and he says, excuse my language, he says, fucking hell, what's he doing that far up? Which is a great line. At the top of the Championship, 6 straight wins for Norwich now. The latest a 4-1 win at Swansea. They were 3 up after 37 minutes. Second place Middlesbrough won 2-1 at Brentford. All the goals in the second half. Leeds are third after 2 late goals saw off Bristol City. Ipswich 5 points adrift at the bottom after a 2-1 defeat at home to 4th placed West Brom on Friday night. In League One, leaders...
You didn't mention Millwall, Bolton Wanderers.
I didn't, Barney. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was 1-1, but it was a tense relegation-haunted clash for both sides.
Did Steve Morrison score for you?
No, Steve Morrison has not. He's still being cryogenically frozen in between every game. Maybe they hadn't thawed him out for this one, but no, it's a draw that leaves both teams still.
It wasn't a good result for either team.
Not a good occasion for humanity generally.
Are Millwall fans? What's their position regarding Neil Harris at the moment?
Well, you always get the odd, let's chuck everything out. But Harris done an amazing job. He just plays very negative, sort of long ball-y kind of football. But I don't know, he'll be fine. He's a club legend.
In League One, Portsmouth won 2-1 at Scunthorpe. They're top. Second place Sunderland and third place Barnsley could only draw their game. Sunderland have gained permission from the Football League, Barry, to host a beam-back screening of their sold-out game at Accrington Stanley as they've sold out their away allocation. £10 will get you a bottle of beer, a pie and peas, and your seat in one of the bars of the stadium would like to see the game. You going to go?
Sounds like a bargain.
Oh, that's really good. You just take the food and go, wouldn't you?
Beer and the dinners. Yeah.
You don't have to watch the game.
No, don't watch the game, just go.
There are no rules about having to stay until full time. AFC Wimbledon won their first game in 9. 8 straight defeats before this weekend's 2-1 win over Southend. In League 2, a stunning fight back from the mighty Cambridge United earned them a 2-2 draw at home to Bury. They're now 21st, just 18 points off top spot. None of the top three won. Lincoln drew, second place MK Dons lost, and Colchester drew at the bottom. Macclesfield won for only the second time this season. Rumours last week that Sol Campbell was in talks to take the vacant manager's role there. And in National League news, this from Johnny Blaine again, the curious case of Chesterfield. They've now gone 18 league matches without a win. That equals a club record. They've also drawn their last 8 league matches in a row, equaling a club record. Bizarrely, they're unbeaten in the last 11 matches in all competitions, which is their best run for 12 years. Susie Rack, you are the Guardian's women's football correspondent.
Correct.
How is the WSL going? It was restructured, wasn't it, in the summer? Was that a good thing or a bad thing, or just depending on who you are, I guess?
I think the idea of a fully professional top tier and second semi-professional second tier is a really good thing, whether it's been done completely in the right way and whether the requirements the clubs have to meet are stringent enough is another thing. Obviously, you had the issue in the week from Football Leaks of players' contracts saying they could be sacked after 3 months of injury. I would argue that any club that can't afford to hold on to injured players and support them through that process shouldn't be considered for top-flight professional football. So it's where you draw the line on professionalism. It's a very exciting league at the moment. Arsenal are absolutely flying. They've had some terrible injuries, but they're completely unstoppable. City are their closest challengers, and they play each other at the weekend in Manchester. So that will be a really exciting game. And actually, in the Championship, if Man United fans are looking for the swagger and arrogance of kind of Man United of old, they should go and watch the women's team in league, because, they thrashed Millwall 8-0 at the weekend, and Casey Stoney's got a really, really young, exciting side. 16-year-old, I think she might be 17 now, actually, Lauren James in midfield, who came from Arsenal, is just phenomenally good.
Are they, are they a money bags team in that division?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, they're a money bags team in both top divisions. I think the rumour is they've put $5 million into the side. That's more than any other team have been given. They've been put up in the best hotels. They're riding the first team bus to games. They have been completely integrated into the club. And that's really good to see. And hopefully we'll make all the other clubs up their game. But whether they should have been put in the second tier in the first place or not gone straight in at the top is another thing, because they are crushing teams every single week. Their first game, they beat Villa 12-0. You know, Millwall 8-0 this weekend. They're going to absolutely walk this league and get promoted. No problem. So should they have started at the top?
We kind of enjoyed and laughed at the Paper, Scissors, Stone refereeing story. Were we wrong to do that?
I thought it was quite funny, to be honest. I thought he was personally fairly sensible to find an alternative over running back to the dressing room. I don't think it was a big deal.
Because there were some in the women's game who said, hey, if this was the men's game, they wouldn't have been, there would have been outrage. And if you've been in the women's game for so long, you know, you're used to only being a news story when it's like this, and that's the problem.
Well, I was surprised by this point, but
I was surprised by how angry Emma Hayes was about it. But she seemed to think it was just indicative of a greater malaise in officiating in the women's game.
Yeah, sometimes it can be just a little bit too quick to jump on these things. So, and I personally didn't see too much of a problem with it. I think there's been much worse refereeing decisions. Chelsea's Drew Spence's horrific tackle on Kim Little that potentially puts her out of Scotland's first ever World Cup campaign. She's one of the best players in the world. Didn't get a red, got a yellow, but definitely should have been a straight red. There's the level of officiating in the women's game, it isn't great, and there's a lot of criticisms that can be made of it, but I mean, finding a way to not have to delay a game, I think, is probably not an issue that we should be jumping on.
You mentioned players who might not make the World Cup. Jordan Nobbs might miss the World Cup for England. How big a deal is that?
Devastating. I was at that game and it was played at Southport, and they've got one main stand and the press box is right up the top, and it was just silent. You could just hear her. You could hear her screams from the pitch. She's not one to go down lightly. And then saw her kind of hobbling out of the stadium afterwards on crutches, her leg in a brace, tear stains still in her kit. It's a really, really big miss for England. She's pivotal to that midfield, and she's crucial to Arsenal. I was worried about how Arsenal would do at the weekend. They conceded first at home to Brighton, came back and won 4-1. They shifted Dominic Bloodworth from defence into midfield to kind of help shore it up. One of the Dutch Euro winners. They seem to be getting around big injury problems, but she's a massive blow.
Is she definitely out?
She's ruptured her ACL. I can't see her getting back in time.
There's no danger of one of those terrible races against time where you take an injured player.
I really hope not, because you know, she's still young. She's 24. You know, she'll make another World Cup. She'll make another couple of World Cups. She's just phenomenally talented. I've been watching her play at Arsenal since she was 17, and it's gutting when she's been in the form that she's been in to see her kind of ruled out, not even kind of a particularly dangerous challenge, just landing awkwardly. I mean, it's another question about standards in women's football is that women get more ACL injuries than men, 6 times more likely, I read in a study, to get an ACL injury. Something to do with the kind of the width of the hips, so meaning that the kind of alignment of your leg is different, you land differently, you twist differently. Boots are designed for men, not women's physiques. So there's not the research or the investment into kind of how we prevent those injuries. So seeing her go down like that with that injury in that manner ahead of a World Cup year where England have got a really good chance is particularly hard to take, particularly as an Arsenal fan.
That is really interesting. Has anyone done any research into that?
There's minimal. There's been a bit in the US, but it's kind of limited. So there's a few experts that kind of
But you think there'd be a commercial imperative? Some sportswear company really should be doing that.
Yeah, and
maybe they just haven't thought of it. I thought you were going to blame the state of the pitches they were being asked to play on or something there. I didn't see you going in that direction at all.
And you're working on a story about women's football in Afghanistan.
The Afghanistan national women's team, who have been crowdfunding to get to training camps. They can't train in the country itself. They had their first training camp in San Francisco in 2014 or 2015, I think. And the entire team have been sidelined by the Afghanistan Football Federation, including the coaches. They've got American coaches who have been working very hard. We raised loads of money selling scarves and things to fund the team to play. They've been slowly climbing up the bottom of the FIFA rankings, and they've been all kicked off the team because they've refused to sign a contract that means that they'd have to they can't take individual sponsorships. You know, a lot of these have club football in various countries. The captain plays in Denmark. They get no money from the Afghanistan Football Federation, and they're having to, they were asked to basically sign away any kind of right to representation in talks with the Afghanistan Football Federation, to commit to not posting anything on social media without the Afghanistan Football Federation's say-so, a whole range of like really, really draconian rules, which in my opinion are just about
control,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the Afghanistan Football Federation controlling the narrative of women's football in their country, where this group of players have been very, very outspoken about the situation for women in Afghanistan and how hard it is for women in the country to play football. That's, yeah, I think that's the crux of it. That's what the players think. But yeah, I've been speaking to a couple of the players, so...
Cool.
Should be a good piece.
All right. Well, we'll look out for that. And we'll finish part two there. We'll start part three in Argentina with Jonathan Wilson. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Never has a game been postponed and rescheduled and back on and postponed so many times in 2 days. Let's talk to Jonathan Wilson in Argentina after the Copa Libertadores second leg between River and Boca was postponed. How are you, Jonathan Wilson?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You went a long way not to watch a football match.
I did. But it was actually a better story. You know, it's obviously very sad to Argentinian football, and you know, there are much wider ramifications here. But you know, from a purely journalistic point of view, it turns out playing the game is massively overrated. It was the old Italian journalist Gianni Brera. He said that the perfect game finishes 0-0. I think he didn't go far enough. The perfect game doesn't kick off. But yeah, obviously this is a very... yeah, Argentina are very upset about this. Commonwealth are very upset about this, and the whole thing is, you know, it's for them is very, very disappointing, very sad.
What was it like being in the stadium?
Well, it's all a bit odd. I mean, there's obviously terrible things happening outside the ground. I mean, we went to the ground. There's four of us who all sort of live in Britain, so we know each other. So there's me, there's Robbie Smith from the New York Times, Miguel Delaney from The Independent, and Josh Robinson from The Wall Street Journal. And so we had some lunch in town, and we got the subter down to Congreso de Tucumán, and it's about a 20-minute walk from there to the ground. And the atmosphere on Saturday, so the game was kicking off at 5 p.m. in theory, we got to Congreso de Tucumán just after 1, probably. And the atmosphere was very good. There's lots of fans about. Everybody was wearing the red and white shirts. There was a lot of singing. There was a sort of great sense of expectation. The weather was that sort of late spring weather you sort of associate with an FA Cup final. It was that sort of real sort of anticipatory vibe about the place. Then in the stadium, the atmosphere was great. There was a little bit of a crush outside. The security was perhaps not as well organised as it might have been. And it was, I don't want to overstate that, but yeah, it was slightly unpleasant. And there were quite a few people in wheelchairs, a couple of pregnant women I saw. And for them, I think it must have been genuinely quite frightening. But we get in, yeah, there's everybody singing, it's all fine. And then I guess probably around about just after 3, the news broke. There's sort of TVs above the press area, so you know, you could see the rolling news. You could see there'd been an incident with the Boca bus. We didn't know what that was to start with. And then slowly word filtered through that missiles have been thrown at it, and that we still don't know. There's police tear gas, or the fans fired some kind of pepper spray that got through the windows, and that affected a lot of players. And then from then on, it's just sort of constantly rumor after rumor after rumor, which you tried to check out. It's not easy from inside the ground, especially as the Wi-Fi signal and the phone signal were coming in and out all the time.
Well, I was going to ask.
And so the game initially was delayed by an hour. It was delayed by another hour and a half, and another quarter of an hour, then another quarter of an hour, and then suddenly it's off.
I did want to ask, is Barney here? How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Barney. How are you?
Yeah, I just wanted to be sure that the terrible scenes and the disorder and violence didn't affect the Wi-Fi in any way. I'm sad to hear that may have been the case.
To be fair, I don't think the disorder and the violent things did affect the Wi-Fi. I think the Wi-Fi was just really bad to start with.
Right.
So, I mean, from a practical point of view, it made things very difficult. I had Wi-Fi on my phone, but not on my laptop, so I found the file just by typing on the phone, which is never ideal.
But as a follow-up, do you think it is possible the presence of so many well-informed, broadly well-read, and exciting English journalists may have affected the mood of the crowd, that it was perhaps just a bit too much for them all to have you there?
That may well have been the straw that broke the camel's back, yeah.
Jonathan, I wanted to ask, had this missile not broken the window of the bus and the game had gone ahead, we'd have all gone, look at that amazing atmosphere, isn't it so intense, and they throw things. And I know whenever I've spoken to footballers who went and played in Turkey for a while, you go, oh, isn't it crazy there, and we sort of celebrate what is essentially violence.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the, you know, the difficulties of this, that we do in Western Europe, where our football culture is quite corporate and quite sanitised, quite anodyne, we do look at South America, and we are excited by the passion and the colour, and, you know, the fact that 60,000 people turn out to watch Boca train on Thursday, and there are so many people there. That situation was so dangerous that the municipality couldn't close the stadium because they breached safety regulations. And the problem is that often goes hand in hand with the violence. And I think it's important that we don't sort of fetishize the colour without realizing the dark side that goes along with that. So we sat down with Alejandro Dominguez, the new president of CONMEBOL, on Friday, and he was saying precisely that part of his job is to try and separate the two, to maintain that sense of sort of colour and authenticity, but somehow get rid of the violence that goes along with it. And that, I think, is hugely difficult, if not impossible. It's so ingrained in the culture, not just of football, but wider society, in Argentina and South America more widely. I don't really know how you begin to tackle that. And I think that is the great sadness. This was meant to be this great showcase event. In terms of global reach, probably the biggest game ever played in South America. And it could have been a great staging post. So this is the new CONMEBOL. This is post-Grondona. This is post-corruption. This is a forward-thinking, youngish president who's got great ideas to try and bring the Libertadores, not up to the Champions League level, but at least run it on Champions League lines. And their first big test of that, and they can't even get the game played. And that, I think, is where the real sadness is.
What next?
For me, I'm just wandering out to have breakfast now. There's some kind of problem with the Airbnb. I don't really understand, but the woman came an hour early and were expecting to kick us out. But I had to come inside to take this call because there's no phone signal in the flat. So I'm going off for breakfast and I'll let them sort it out. Rory and Miguel, who I'm staying with. And I'll go back and hopefully my bags just aren't on the seat when I get back there. Mm.
Producer Jonathan suggesting that answer may not make the pod.
What next for the Copa Libertadores, Jonathan?
Well, that's a very good question. There's a meeting in Asuncion on Tuesday, tomorrow. I think 10 a.m. Paraguay time, and that will decide when, where, and if the second leg is played. They've got a problem with policing in that the G20 summit starts in Buenos Aires on Thursday, and that's obviously a huge drain on the police. You know, to ask them to handle that plus a major game, to be honest, they didn't handle very well on Saturday when they had nothing else on, is obviously impossible. There's a little bit of time pressure in that the Club World Cup starts on December the 12th, and you know, you need a Libertadores winner to represent South America there. I think they're talking about December the 10th has been the cut-off for that. So the date that's sort of floating around this morning is December the 8th as being the only realistic time when it could be played. Where could it play? We're not sure whether that'll be at Rivers Ground, at El Monumental. We don't know whether fans will be allowed in or not. We don't know. There's some talk that they might play it actually in the UAE. It's almost like as a qualifying game for the Club World Cup. Although that then opens the door to other confederations saying, well, hang on, why is FIFA trying to block La Liga playing games in the US? You know, if you can suddenly stop playing games anywhere in the world, you know, is that the end of the wedge? So, I mean, it's a mess and we don't know. And to be honest, I'm not really sure that the game should be played. Carlos Tevez was pointing this out yesterday, that in 2015, Boca fans fired pepper spray at River players in the Libertadores. The game was called off and it was awarded to River. And he's saying, well, why is this any different? And I sort of think, even more broadly than that, if you don't sanction River for this, if you say to fans, you can do this, you can try and intimidate the opposition, and the consequences are minimal, well, it's just going to keep going. So if CONMEBOL really do want to try and clean up South American football, if they do want to take away the violence, I think they need to make a stand, and they probably need to either not award the Libertadores this season, or they need to give it to Boca.
Two questions. Will you be back in time for the live show? And will you go back if they do reschedule this game?
I will not go back if they reschedule it. They've had the chance, they've missed it. And yes, I will be back for the live show. I'm flying back today. And I'm going up to Sunderland. I'll be down from Sunderland on Thursday in time for the Emmanuel Centre trains committing.
Perfect. And you'll have some content as well, which is great. Thanks, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Sid is not around today, but in La Liga, of the top eight going into this weekend, only 1-1. That was Sevilla, who go top after a 1-0 win over Real Valladolid. The big news was Eibar's 3-0 thrashing of Real Madrid in Santiago Solari's first game in permanent charge. That makes it 5 defeats in 13 games. They only lost 6 in the whole of last season. This just a couple of days after Sergio Ramos was forced to deny reports that he failed a drugs test after the 2017 Champions League final. That is the latest from the Footy Leaks series in Der Spiegel. Barcelona and Atletico Madrid played out a 1-1 draw. Diego Costa scoring his first goal since February to open the scoring. Ousmane Dembele coming off the bench to equalise. His 5th such game-changing goal this season. We will, of course, get Sid's thoughts on the state of La Liga on a later pod. Now to Italy, where Paolo Bandini WhatsApps us his latest report.
On the weekend when Argentina's Superclásico was twice postponed, over in Italy, the city of Genoa hosted a very successful derby between its two leading teams. Now, that might sound like a bit of an odd parallel to draw, but I raise it because the city council in Genoa has since written to the presidents of both Boca Juniors and River Plate, offering to host them for their second leg of their Libertadores final. Their letter makes reference to the fact that there is a demographic in Buenos Aires of people who can chart their family history back to Genoans who emigrated from Italy to Argentina in the late 19th and early 20th century, and for which reason a link between the two cities does remain. Whether that is a sufficient basis for shifting a cup final across the Atlantic, we shall have to wait and see. But it was an excellent Derby della Lanterna on Sunday, the Lighthouse Derby, between Genoa and Sampdoria. The city has been through an incredibly difficult period since the collapse of the Morandi Bridge in August, a tragedy in which 43 people died and which has seen many more forced to abandon homes in the vicinity. So this was a game played against a very particular backdrop, and it was a testament to the residents of the city, I thought, to see it played in the best possible spirit with spectacular support at Marassi. And I would encourage listeners to go and check out the pre-game choreography because it was spectacular. And really just an entertaining game between two teams who both came in on the back of 3-game losing runs. Fabio Quagliarella opened the scoring for Samp before Krzysztof Piątek equalised. The Polish striker is the first player in Serie A to hit double figures this season, but he actually hadn't scored in 5 games since Ivan Juric returned as manager of Genoa, a fact which had already put the latter's job at risk. The game finished 1-1 with Juric getting himself sent from the touchline late on and rather brilliantly telling the officials, "You have no souls, this is the derby." Meanwhile, Juventus extended their lead at the top of the table to 8 points, courtesy of Napoli's draw against Chievo. Roma prepared for their midweek Champions League clash with Real Madrid by losing to Udinese, admittedly not as badly as the European champions did to Eibar. Inter got set for their Champions League game against Tottenham, meanwhile, by thrashing Frosinone 3-0.
And from Paolo's WhatsApp to Archie Rintuts, which will include Bayern Munich in crisis. Archie, take it away.
Welcome to the Kebab Shop, where for Bayern Munich's opponents, the Bundesliga season gets tastier and tastier by the week. This weekend, the champions for the past 6 years, remember, drew 3-3 at home to promoted Fortuna Düsseldorf, who are second from bottom. Bayern now 5th on 21 points. Coach Niko Kovac said after the game, "We did fairly well over the 90 minutes, if you exclude the goals." quite important, that. Bayern were 3-1 up with 15 minutes to go. For the third time in their last four home league games, though, they conceded a late equaliser. Watford loanee Dodi Luque Bakio completing his hat-trick to rescue a famous draw for the visitors. The problems are bigger than Kovac alone at Bayern, but as it stands, he'll do well to make it past Christmas. What makes it worse for him is that his previous club, Eintracht Frankfurt, are flying. I went to see them at Augsburg this weekend. Not their best performance, but they still won 3-1. Bit more detail on them. Mentioned their front three a few weeks back of Ante Rebic, Luka Jovic and Sebastian Haller. They need mentioning again. Haller and Rebic on target this weekend. The trio accounting for 23 goals between them now this season. The same as Bayern have managed. Jovic and Haller are the joint top scorers in the division on 9. And no player in Europe's top five leagues, not even Messi, Mbappe, Neymar, Ronaldo, has more goals and assists than Haller. 15 altogether. Getting some stick from his teammates that it's still not enough for him to get in the French team, but keep an eye on him. Frankfurt in third on 23 points then. And in second, 3 points ahead of them, are Borussia Mönchengladbach. 4-1 winners over Hannover, despite conceding after 22 seconds. Shout out for Torgan Hazard, who's second in the scoring charts after his eighth of the season. One more, too, than brother Edin at Chelsea. But joining Jovic and Haller on top with 9 goals is Borussia Dortmund's Paco Alcácer. On Friday, it was announced he'll be joining Dortmund on a permanent deal come the end of the season. And on Saturday, he popped up 2 minutes after coming on at Mainz to give them the lead. The home side hit back, but Lukas Piszczek clinched a 2-1 win. Not Dortmund's slickest display, but they're top of the pile on 30 points.
Thank you, Archie. In France, PSG won again. 14 wins from 14 now. That was without Neymar or Mbappe, but PSG are claiming they are going to be ready to face Liverpool. And Thierry Henry has won his first game as manager of Monaco. A free kick from Falcao away at Caen has pulled them to within 2 points of safety. Ireland, Barry.
Sorry, Max, you didn't mention that PSG are a tool of the Qatari state.
No, I failed to do that.
It's an example of sports washing, something I've written about extensively.
I'd like to apologise for not picking them up on that.
Oh, hang on. Yeah. You haven't mentioned all the other French clubs who are sponsored by people that might not be morally...
Oh, could you give me a list? It's quite a long pod today.
The fact you don't know them shows your bias.
Absolutely right. I just care what happens on the pitch. I don't care who did it. Frankly, the more murderers there are that I can watch playing the beautiful game, the better.
Winning means that you're right.
Mm. Ireland, Barry, not winning.
but speaking of not winning, Ireland.
But they've got Mick McCarthy. He'll do it for a couple of years. And regardless of whether he's a huge success or not, he'll then leave and Stephen Kenny will come in. Who in the meantime will take charge of the under-21s, and even if he's terrible at that, will still get the top job.
That appears to be the state of things at the moment. It's an appointment. Not the appointment of McCarthy didn't take many people by surprise, but this having his successor in place did. I think it particularly took Dundalk by surprise because they now lose their manager and are a bit upset about that because they're not losing him because he's taking the senior job. He's only going to manage the under-21s. So, yeah, it's weird. It might work. It might be a complete disaster. Whoever is in charge, McCarthy's going to have a dream team. Terry Connor, his usual number two, is going to be with him. And Robbie Keane will be working as an assistant. And they will have a tough job because Ireland don't have very many good players at the moment.
We'll finish the pod with this email that we received. Hi, Max and Barry and team. Greetings from Toronto. We are dedicated listeners to the pod and none more so than Peter, last name Cram, our husband/father. He actually has almost no interests or hobbies beyond listening to Football Weekly and streaming EPL and Champions League games here in Canada. He's turning 50 on the 1st of December, and a happy birthday greeting on your show is the ultimate birthday present. Thank you so much. Keep up the hard work. We love the pod. Yours in football, Margie, spouse, Nolan, kid, Elliot, kid. Barry, would you like to wish Peter
Happy birthday on your half century, Peter, but I think you should possibly take up some new interests. I mean, don't stop listening to us, but, you know, you could listen to us while pottering about in the garden or you know, going for nice long walks or something.
I wrote on behalf of Football Weekly, Peter, thank you. Perhaps get some other interests. Barney, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Susie, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Baz.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.